Our second discussion then is going to be about the theory of evolution. We've looked at the fact that the biblical view teaches that God created the heavens and the earth, of course, in 6 days. And I should preface this talk by saying that the position of young earth creationism is just not a very cool position, even within Christianity. Most evangelical seminarists, however good they may be in many other areas, teach an old earth position. They take the Big Bang, which, by the way, has all kinds of problems with it anyway, but they take the Big Bang hypothesis for granted. And most Christian apologists as well, those that have ministries defending the Christian faith to the world, in other words, to explain the Christian faith and to answer all of the objections to Christianity, nearly all of them hold to an old earth creationist position. It's just a shame. It really is a shame because, you know, if I was an unbeliever, I would say, well, look, you don't believe your own Bible. That's what it says. And it just looks like special pleading to me when Christians try to escape what seems to be pretty obvious on the face of the scripture. It's not a good way of winning people to Christ. So we're dealing here then with evolution. I'm going to call it evolution because that's how it's brought up. Sometimes called evolution if I remember. I like evolution anyway because it has that nice phonetic connection to it. The impossible theory. The first thing we need to do in any discussion of evolution, and whether you are a Christian or a non-Christian, this is important, is we have to define what we mean by the word evolution, because it has a number of different meanings. Remember our discussion there about equivocal meanings, and equivocation is a logical fallacy. So if you use one word in two different ways in the same context to throw a person, and a person takes you to mean the same thing when you mean different things, okay, you are committing a logical fallacy. It happens all the time in discussions of evolution. Mainly between the definitions of microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution is that which we observe. You can breed certain kinds of dogs, certain kinds of cats or cattle and so on, and you can get a different strain. That's how, for the most part, we got these different strains within the genus of cats, dogs, cows, or whatever. That's microevolution. That's a fact. There's no Christian would deny microevolution. But when we're talking about evolution, and the term evolution as I put it in my heading here, I'm talking about something different than that. I'm talking about macroevolution. I'm talking about the story that is spun out without any corroboration whatsoever by the Discovery Channel and National Geographic and Jane Goodall and the rest of them. And that is, and I've given you a definition here, the belief that all the vast diversity of living systems evolved by blind and purposeless forces of chance and necessity from a common ancestor, which itself evolved by some chance spontaneous chemical process from non-living matter. That's what we're talking about. That you and I came from some form of collision millions of years ago of non-living chemicals. That the incredibly complex structure of the cell, even the simplest cell, evolved from these chance combinations. That's a very carefully worded definition. I've called it, notice, a belief, not a theory, because it really doesn't qualify as a scientific theory. It's not falsifiable. Why is not the theory of evolution, speaking about macroevolution, why is it not falsifiable, folks? No, it's actually much more simple. It is not falsifiable because people will not allow it to be falsified. People that believe it. It's true. Don't you know it? They don't treat it as a theory. They call it a scientific theory. In fact, well, Richard Dawkins and others call it a fact. But they treat it as a fact. It is not falsifiable. Now, every scientific theory, to qualify as a scientific theory, must be falsifiable. In other words, it must be able, at least in theory, to bring in other evidence against it. If, after all the kinds of experiments and proving of it and so on, it is seen that it is absolutely true in all states and all conditions, then it becomes a law, okay, like the law of gravity. Under circumstances that there are on this earth, if you climb to the top of this building and throw yourself off the top of it, you will not land softly. That's a scientific law, and Newton gave us the computations for it. Now, the theory of evolution is not even a theory, because the people that teach it and believe it will not allow it to be falsified. That's the big problem about teaching it in the schools. There's nothing wrong with teaching it in the schools. I was taught it. In England, you get taught it. I mean, British people are very, very proud of the fact that Charles Darwin, Wallace and Huxley and so on, they were the people that kicked this thing off. And so evolution is looked upon with pride over there, as well as just as, you know, with the rest of the world, as some kind of fact that we have to accept. It's okay to teach it in schools. It's okay to teach it, and we ought to teach it to our young children, even as Christians. It's important to teach it to them. I teach it to mine. But I do not teach it as fact. I do not teach it as a scientific theory. I teach it as a belief. I teach it as a story which may or may not correspond with the real world that we live in. And of course, if you believe that evolution is not falsifiable, in other words, if you will not admit for any counter-evidence against it, then it becomes dangerous to teach, because it's not been established as a law. So therefore, it's just established by what? By the people with the power, basically. It's their belief system that's being imposed, with no others being allowed in. And this is, by the way, the reason why the intelligent design advocates, who have a great deal of very strong scientific evidence behind them, or the creationists, like Answers in Genesis and so on, this is why they push for creationism to be taught, not as a theological fact, but just as another scientific model or explanation for origins. But it's not allowed. So it's a belief that the vast diversity of living systems, there are things out there. For example, there is a particular kind of a bee in the world. The male bee hatches first, and the male bee doesn't have a female bee to mate with. But it's okay, because there's a particular kind of a plant that it goes to that gives off the same scent that the female bee will give off when she comes. That bee goes to the plant, comes out after digging its head, of course, in the plant and so on, and cross-pollinates the plant as it flies from one plant to another. That's how that plant continues to live from generation to generation, by this bee. But its whole survival depends on that male bee being born before the female bee, because once the female bee shows up, the bees are not interested in the plants anymore. They're interested in each other. All kinds of things like that. Just so many different systems like that that there are in the world. All of this vast diversity that we see all comes from evolution, by blind, so there's no foresight, purposeless, there's no mind involved, no thinking involved at all, blind and purposeless, no significance, no meaning, forces of chance and necessity, which we'll look at in a minute, from a common ancestor. A cell that just happened to come into existence somehow. Amazingly complex things. You know, when Darwin was alive, they had this word protoplasm. They believed that the cell was really, really simple. And so it could be explained very easily by a primordial soup where all kinds of chemicals were bashing into each other. You know, could create something eventually. But now we know that even the most simple cells have motors within them. Of course, the DNA molecule with its encyclopedic volumes of information in it. Do you know that these cells have stacking systems in them? The new genomics has looked at the cell, and they've seen that just as our computers have a file, and you can put another file within that file, and another file in that file, okay? That's what the simplest cell has. Information within information, within information. A storage system like that. Very, very complex. Moreover, the complexity is all needed in order for the thing to work, whatever particular aspect of the cell is being spoken about. For example, here's a quotation, as one geneticist says, "What makes the proteins that are necessary to make the protein? This is one of the unanswered riddles of biochemistry. Which came first, proteins or protein synthesis? If proteins are needed to make proteins, how did the whole thing get started? The end result of protein synthesis is required before it can begin." You see that? You need proteins to make proteins. And you need not only proteins, but you need the equipment and the development of the protein so that it synthesizes with other proteins, you see? Just a protein on its own isn't going to do anything. You need other proteins for it to synthesize it. And so, can you see, you have to have complexity. You have to have certain specifications. Michael Behe speaks about a mouse trap, and he says that you can't just have a spring and a block of wood. That's not going to catch mice. You can't have the hammer or any of the other things and just leave them around loosely and expect that the mouse is going to trip over them and die. You have to have them put together in a certain way and pulled back so that when the mouse takes the cheese, the actual trap springs and kills the mouse. Those things are needed in order to have a mouse trap. They all have to be working and put in the exact place that they need to function at the same time. And that's the same thing with the cell, only with far, far more complexity. So we have these tremendously complex things that we're told come about just by chance and necessity from a common ancestor, which itself evolved by some chance spontaneous chemical process that has never been duplicated in the laboratory. It doesn't matter what you've been told about Stanley Miller and the rest of it, hasn't been done from non-living matter. In other words, they believe that the scientific law of abiogenesis, that life does not come from non-life, that actually that law did not exist at one time, and that just once, or maybe twice, nature found a way, to quote Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park, nature found a way to barge its way through a scientific law. Life coming from non-life. Life does not come from non-life. That's a scientific fact. It's not a theory, it's a fact. And it can be demonstrated, but they don't believe that when it comes to macroevolution. So here we are. There's our description. That's what we're supposed to believe. That's what's been taught. Now, you're never given all of the information that you need. You're never given it by David Attenborough. You're never given it by any of the personalities on TV or by the textbooks that you use or by Futuyama or any of these people. You're never given the information that you need to know where they're getting this from. You're just supposed to believe the story. And then, you see, they do some real science with real facts that can be repeated and can be demonstrated, and they throw that into the mix, and you can't sort out the fact from the fiction. You believe the facts demonstrated in the laboratory come from the explanation of macroevolution, but you're never given any kind of evidence for macroevolution. You never will be either, because there isn't any evidence for it. There is no evidence that life came from non-life or that we came from monkeys. People say, well, the DNA is the same. Well, of course the DNA is the same. The wood is the same here as it is in that bench. That doesn't mean this is a bench. It just means that the person who made this and the person who made that, the humans that did it, used the same materials. That's all it means. Which seems to be kind of a smart thing to do. That's, by the way, why we can eat things. We can eat meat and plants and other things. We can eat them because they are made up of the same kind of DNA, the same materials, if you like. Okay, that was a pretty long introduction, so I'll get going on this first point. It's never been observed. This kind of evolution has never been observed. You don't observe it now. You don't observe it in the past, in the fossil record. And I assure you, you won't observe it in the future. In the fossil record, where there should be not just fully formed animals, whether they're extinct or still living today, you shouldn't just be able to dig up skeletons and fossils of extinct animals or living animals, but you should be able to dig up intermediate forms where one genus is changing into another genus, shouldn't you? They don't just pop into existence. One day it's a dog, next day it gives birth to a cat or something else. That doesn't happen. We never observe that. Now, according to Mendel's law, by the way, it can't happen. We ought to be able to see that in the fossils. Do we find that? We don't find it. Years ago, this is about 20 years ago now, when I was younger and more stupid than I am now, and I'm still not so young, but still fairly stupid. In Britain, there was this big furore about why Charles Darwin's face was not on one of the bills, the £10 bill or a £20 bill or something like that. Because after all, Charles Darwin was so important. And there was a letter in the Guardian newspaper there by Sir Andrew Huxley of that famous family, chairman of the Royal Society in England, and he was pleading that Darwin have his face on a bill. And he said, after all, many of the gaps that there were in Darwin's time have now been filled. So I wrote to him. I didn't write to him as a Christian. I wrote to him as somebody who just, you know, confused. And said, well, look, I thought that it was because of the fact that these gaps have not been closed, that we haven't found the intermediate forms, that people like Stephen Jay Gould over in America have postulated this punctuated equilibrium, where things do spring very, very rapidly from one genus into another genus. He wrote back to me. I got a number of lectures and some other things, and he said to me, and I still have the material, he said to me that if you look in the lectures, I have given you an example of an intermediate fossil. You know what the intermediate fossil was? Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx. That fossilized bird. It's a bird, folks. It just doesn't exist anymore. It's not extant anymore. But it's a bird. You say, well, it had teeth. So it had teeth. So what? It was still a bird. There's no explanation ever given. If you ask for intermediate forms, all you'll be shown to be shown microevolution as evidence for macroevolution. Microevolution is evidence for microevolution. It is never evidence for macroevolution. So be very careful there. Science is supposed to be dealing with what we can observe and what we can test and what we know to be the case. If we cannot observe macroevolution going on now, and if we can't observe it in the fossil record, we oughtn't to believe it. We might hold it as a possibility, a possible explanation that we don't have any facts for, but we certainly shouldn't be teaching it to our kids and having PBS programs about it. It doesn't deserve that kind of attention. Why does it get it? It gets it, folks, for a very, very good reason. The reason that Darwin formulated it in the first place. The reason that the atheists jumped all over it when The Origin of the Species came out in 1859. First edition sold out straight away. They were ready for it. Because it's an alternative creation myth. As Richard Dawkins, the arch evolutionist in England, said, Darwin made it intellectually respectable to be an atheist. Darwin, I mean, their whole case is based on the theory of evolution, macroevolution. Just don't ask them to prove macroevolution. They'll tell you you're supposed to believe it. Okay, secondly, they say that everything can be explained. All of the great diversity, all of the life forms that there are, all of the complexity of the cell and so on, by two things, chance and necessity. Chance is random processes or events. There's no reason for them, they just happen. I had my coffee up here, I've drunk it all now, but if I had a full cup of coffee and I accidentally knocked it over and it spilled all the way down here, trickled down the organ, and trickled all the way down here and down on the floor and everything, if I could repeat that, do it again, it would not have exactly the same pattern. The pattern is a chance happening. Same as if you roll the dice 100 times and you record every single turn of the dice and then you do it another 100 times, you'll have a different turn of the dice. You'll have a discrete set of events within 100 times toss of the dice from another 100 times toss of the dice. That's chance. It may happen this way, it may happen some other way. There's no kind of way of figuring it out. And then necessity, what they mean by necessity, although they don't put a lot of emphasis on this, is that the forces producing specific outcomes under the right conditions. The problem is they can never define the right conditions, and they can never define the forces. They loosely say the force of gravity or something else, but they never explain how that can be done, and why that would be the case. So chance and necessity is all you've got to make everything that we see, everything that we experience here. Well, first of all, the problem with it is that it's very vague. Chance and necessity. What do we really mean? Where's the power within chance? Where's the power within what we call necessity? Why is it necessary? And if it's necessary, then are there some laws that govern that necessity, and where did they come from? So you're really not saying very much when you talk about chance and necessity. You need more. Evolutionists are always saying, well, you believe God created everything, and so that's an explanation for everything. You don't have to do any science. You heard that before? Of course, that is not what we believe. We do believe that God created everything, but we believe also that God has given us minds and given us an environment to explore and a mandate to explore it. To do science. And so all of the great founders of modern science were Christians because of that. But if you believe in chance and necessity, then can't you say that, well, you just believe chance and necessity is the explanation for everything, therefore you might as well not do science. Chance is random. You can't specify what will happen by chance. If you could, it wouldn't be chance. Is it therefore prescriptive or descriptive? It has to be descriptive. Something happened by chance. How do you know? Well, because it just happened. It can't be repeated. I can't give you a prescription for why it happened, because if I could, I would not call it chance. That's important that you understand that. Chance events are hugely improbable. And so, Jeff over here, if I gave you some dye and I asked you to roll them 100 times, if I gave Sarah some dice and she rolled them 100 times, and I gave Luke some dice and he rolled them 100 times, what is the chance that in recording what Jeff and Sarah and Luke rolled, that they would roll exactly the same numbers in exactly the same order? It's hugely improbable. Hugely improbable. This is an explanation for everything that's here, all of the great complexity that we have. For things like mine, an explanation for how I can actually do science, how people can build bridges and send rockets to the moon. Chance. We're not on really very solid ground here, I don't think. Chance events never match pre-specified patterns. So, just say you come to Victoria Harbour in Canada, you're coming on the boat, and it says, "Welcome to Victoria." In stones. Or you go to Disney World and you have the flower bed there. Welcome to Disney World. Or as many hillsides where there are towns in the US, you look up on the hillside and they have a big letter for the beginning of the town, which corresponds to the name of the town. Okay? We know that is a specified pattern that we recognize. It's a U. Okay? And this U not only is a specified pattern that I recognise elsewhere, it also corresponds to the name of the town. Or, welcome to Victoria is a pattern that I can read and understand as language, which also corresponds to where I'm coming to. You see that? Chance events, the rolling of rocks down a hillside, never match pre-specified patterns. The reason that it says welcome to Victoria in front of the bay in Victoria and not welcome to Singapore is because somebody has said we're in Victoria and so it should say welcome to Victoria. They've pre-specified what's going to go there, you see. Chance doesn't do that. You have to have a mind to do that. What we find, though, unfortunately, for evolutionists, is pre-specified patterns all over the place in nature. Things that we know through personal experience can only come about by somebody actually thinking about it and putting it there, such as information. And then chance is often reified. And when you're dealing with an evolutionist, listen out for this. They will often reify blind purposeless forces. What does reify mean? Well, the pagans, and even paganism today, reifies nature. So there are gods in the trees, and there are gods in the sky. They personify these things. Freud said this. I don't believe in hardly anything Freud said, but he was right about this. He said that many people, to cope with the forces that are around them that they can't control, they give them names so it helps them feel that they can control them. And he said that's an explanation for God. Well, evolutionists reify chance. They're always talking about it as if it actually thinks about things. Evolution somehow found a way. Really? I understand humans and animals and thinking things find ways. They think about ways to go and they find ways. But chance, particles, mindless, blind, purposeless things, they don't find ways. They go ways according to certain laws, by the way. So you often find you have this talk about chance as if it was a person. Not a person, doesn't have a mind, doesn't think, doesn't know what it's doing, okay? Third, macroevolution does not account for complex specified information. Now that's important, we have those three words together. Complex specified information. You can have information if you have a Scrabble board and you just throw it up in the air and all of the pieces come down. You may not have it spelling anything that you can actually understand. But you have a pattern there. You have some kind of information. That's called Shannon information. But it's not specified. It's not a pattern that we recognize. It's just a jumble. Evolution does not account for complex specified information, where you have many things within the cell that tell other things in the cell what to do, where to go, how many of these to make, when to stop. That's information. Now, if I'm going to send a fax to you, I get my paper, and say I'm in Fort Worth, Texas, and I put my paper into the fax machine, and I press the buttons and so on, I press your number, and out of the end, you get a sheet of paper with the same information on it, okay? And you think, wow, these fax machines are amazing because the same piece of paper that he put in Fort Worth came out where I am in San Luis Obispo. No, you don't think that at all. There is no material correspondence between the piece of paper that I put in Fort Worth and the piece of paper that you get out in San Luis Obispo. But the information that's on it somehow travelled down the wires or through the air, and you got the same looking piece of paper with exactly the same information on it from 1,000, 1,500 miles away. Information is immaterial. Let's see, somebody who's not doing anything. Randall. Randall, can you go into your house and see your fridge and get me three, please? And then come back. Go on. Go and get me three. I need three.
Three what?
Exactly. Three what? That isn't three, it's a symbol of three, isn't it? It's a numeral. Just like there are other symbols of three in the world. None of them are the number, because the number's immaterial. That's why Randall can't go to his refrigerator and get me three. Because three is an immaterial thing. You say, three what? You see? Three is an immaterial reality. Numbers are immaterial realities, aren't they? They are complex. They can get very complex. They are certainly specified. We know what we mean by get me three. It's information, yes? When we're dealing with numbers, we're dealing with information. If we're not, then we can't build cars and we can't build bridges and we can't send rockets to the moon. Obviously we can. So they are informational. Evolution does not account for complex specified information. How do numbers evolve? They're immaterial. They're not affected by things bouncing against each other in some prebiotic soup. Laws of logic. In fact, laws at all. We'll get to that in the next lecture. Get Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, and read it and see how amazingly intricate the cell is. You see mechanisms, machines in the cell which you cannot see unless you magnify it 50,000 times. These things exist. They work in us. And they do specified and very complex jobs. Far more complicated than any kind of computer that man has devised. You cannot account for that by chance and necessity. In fact, I have another quotation here that might help. This is from this book, actually, Signature in the Cell. I recommend this one. DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. It's just come out by Stephen C. Meyer. He says, visitors to Mount Rushmore in South Dakota infer the past action of intelligent design upon seeing some unusual shapes etched in the rock face. Why? Scientific question, why? The shapes on the hillside are certainly unusual and irregularly shaped, and thus, in this context, improbable. Okay, you don't come across Mount Rushmores every time you turn a corner. But beyond that, observers recognize a pattern in the shapes that they know from an independent realm of experience, from seeing the faces of ex-presidents in photographs or paintings. The patterns on the mountain match patterns the observers know from elsewhere. The information in the cell match patterns that we ourselves use all the time in the world. You cannot explain information on the basis of chance and necessity. The only explanation that we know of for information is mind. Information comes from minds. Here's a little statistic for you. I don't like dealing with statistics very much, but he goes into it an awful lot in this book, and he really gives you the math for it. But just think about this. We have chance and necessity, and we're trying to explain not the great complexity that we see today, but how it all started. Okay, the first cell. And Meyer, he's dealing with the computations by others, says here, the odds of getting even one functional protein of modest length, 150 amino acids, many of them have thousands of amino acids, but of modest length by chance from a prebiotic soup is no better than one chance in 10 to the power of 164. Okay, 164th power. Now, imagine I had you in a room and I said, I've lost something. Can you help me find it? I've lost a needle. Okay. I lost it out there. Sure, I'll try and help you. So I open the door and instead of a haystack, which would be bad enough, I show you something the size of Mount Everest. It's in there somewhere. What would you say? That's impossible. Okay, now listen to this. He says, to have a realistic chance of finding the needle, even in a haystack, we will need to search for a long, long time. Now consider that there are only 10 to the power of 80 protons, neutrons and electrons in the observable universe. Thus, if the odds of finding a functional protein by chance on the first attempt had been 1 in 10 to the power of 80, we could have said that's like finding a marked particle, proton, neutron or electron, a much smaller needle, among all the particles of the universe, a much larger haystack. Unfortunately, the problem is much worse than that. With odds standing at 1 chance in 10 to the 164th power of finding a functional protein among the possible 150 amino acid compounds, the probability is 84 orders of magnitude, or powers of 10, smaller than the probability of finding a marked particle in the whole universe. Another way to say that is the probability of finding a functional protein by chance alone is a trillion, 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 trillion times smaller than the odds of finding a single specified particle among all the particles in the universe. You can believe that if you want. I do not believe that. That's nonsense. You cannot believe something like that and be a rational person. You can't. In the next talk, we're going to talk about why it's rational to believe in a creation worldview. If you reject a creation worldview, this is where chance and necessity gives you. There's no chance, and it's certainly not necessary. You cannot account for complex specified information. In other words, the self, the most basic ingredient of life, from the theory of evolution. It can't get going, never mind the fact that it contravenes the law of abiogenesis. Fourthly, if macroevolution is true, then what I'm thinking and what I'm believing and what you're thinking and believing and what Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Francisco Ayala or any of these, what they are thinking and believing, and what the rapists and the murderers in our prisons, what they are thinking and believing, is just the product of the firing of the synapses in their brains. As Richard Dawkins would have it, all of our mind is really just neural activity. And our thoughts, our minds, are some kind of epiphenomenon that sit on top of the electrochemical activity of our brains. If that is the case, and that has to be the case in an evolutionary scenario, then everything that we think is just determined by certain collisions of chemicals within our material structure. We could not think, we could not do anything other than what we think or do. It's utterly deterministic. You see that? If you can explain our belief systems, and these people, although they never prove it, think they can. Daniel Dennett, worth reading for a laugh, in one of his latest books, tries to explain religion, belief in God, as just the brain not working properly. In fact, Richard Dawkins says that belief in God is a disease. They talk in these materialistic terms. If that's the case, I can't help what I believe, and Richard Dawkins can't help what he believes, and Jeffrey Dahmer couldn't help what he believed. And we need to, if we really believe that, even saying this is self-contradictory, self-refuting, but we ought to have no laws stopping people doing what they would be inclined to do. And we need to release all of the rapists and all of the murderers and all of the thieves and the whatever, the embezzlers. We need to release them from prison. Because they're not responsible. They just did what their brains told them to do at one particular time. It's utterly deterministic. That's not the world we live in. And we know that. So Richard Dawkins, he lives in Oxford. So he drives there, or he goes on his bike to his university, and he chains up his bicycle outside the university. Why does he do that? Because he lives in a world where he knows if he doesn't do that, somebody's going to come along and steal his bike. And by the way, if somebody stole the bike, what would he do? Go to the police, wouldn't he? And say that that person stole my bike, and he's wrong and he needs to be punished. Well, why? If the person that stole the bike needed the bike and he thought, well, that's a nice bike, I'm going to take that one. You see, If it's utterly determined that he take the bike, then Richard Dawkins should just allow him to take the bike. It's deterministic. It's also fatalistic. There's no, absolutely no purpose to your life. You are not a person of significance in the evolutionary scenario. You are just the chance combination of matter and motion. You are a cosmic accident. That's all you are. Every birthday card that you write, every poem that you may write, every song that you may sing, every thesis that you may write, it's all without significance. Every piece of music that you love to listen to, there's no meaning, there's no significance to it at all. It's utterly fatalistic because it's utterly deterministic. And of course it's nihilistic as well, because it fails to explain our experiences, the things that are really important to us. And this is my fifth and last point. Macroevolution is impossible because it does not explain anything. It certainly doesn't explain our day-to-day experience. It is useless as a worldview, yet it parades around as a worldview. Why does Dawkins think that Darwin made it intellectually respectable to be an atheist? Because he is placing his faith in an unproven belief that we came from non-life, which came from matter, which came from non-matter, from nothing. Why does he believe that that's intellectually respectable? Because he doesn't go there. He builds his rhetoric and his scenarios in a different direction. It sounds really good. You know, if we gave into everything that sounded really good, we'd all be driving real clunkers for cars. The salesman would see, well, here's another sucker coming, and I can tell him this nice story, and he'll believe it. You just put it in the right way, and some people believe anything. That's what's going on when we're dealing with macroevolution. No factual basis for it at all. It explains nothing. It doesn't explain why we look at a sunset and we go, wow, and a cow looks at a sunset and goes, moo. But folks, we need an explanation for that. When we're lining up for something, say we're at the DMV, and we are lining up there and there's those impossible lines, and somebody comes in and just walks straight in front of us, we want to tap them on the shoulder and we want to say, oi, I've been waiting here for an hour. You can't just cut in like that. That's wrong. You need to get to the back of the line. And we expect the person that we're talking to realize that that's wrong, don't we? We expect that there is a moral law that not only I, but he and everybody else understands. How does evolution explain the existence of that moral law? It's certainly true that we expect that. Yes? Do you believe racism is wrong? Do you believe child neglect is wrong? Do you believe what the Nazis did to the Jews was wrong? Why was it wrong? Why is racism wrong? Why shouldn't we all be white supremacists? You see, we know these things are wrong. We stand up and say these things are wrong and they're evils because we believe in a world in which there are moral absolutes. But if the way that I am believing is simply explained, like my belief in God or my belief in the supremacy of the white race, or my belief in the superiority of the male over the female, if that is conditioned by the firing of neurons in my brain, why is it wrong? There's no explanatory power in evolution. And we could go into that, we'll go into that more in the next talk. But just think about this. Creationism starts with a mind, capital M. Fabulous mind, a brilliant mind beyond any comprehension. A mind that can design and manufacture the amazing machinery in the cell. A mind that can create us and give us minds. That can identify numbers and can identify laws of logic that he's put in there. The minds that can interact with our environment as a real environment and not imaginary environment. With creationism, we start with a God who creates all of that. So we start with mind, and we come to information, we come to our explanations about the world. Evolution starts with matter and motion, chance and necessity, and arrives somehow at mind. Guys, that is not the world we live in. The number three cannot be explained by random chance and necessity. It is explained by the fact that we are created in God's image, and God has put an ordered universe out there for us to explore. We have a responsibility, an ethical duty to explore it to His glory. Evolution is an impossible belief.
Of course, you say evolution starts with man and emotion, and that's a problem in itself.
Yeah, how do you explain that? Yeah, of course. There are no final explanations. You know, the way that they answer that is they just say, well, that's not an important question. That's how they deal with it.
So we wonder how these began, how they began is not important.
Yeah. All of the big questions. Why am I here? What's it all about? Why is there evil in the world? Why is there something rather than nothing? Evolution doesn't even try to explain those things. The latest thing is the multiverse theory. We can't find any evidence in the universe that we've got, so we'll have to hypothesize multiverses where anything is possible, you know, if we have enough universes. So we have universes where it's okay to rape babies, for example, in the evolutionary hypothesis. We have universes where we have minds that just pop into existence and out of existence. By the way, we might live in that universe. Just to conclude here, Meyer writes, since the intelligent design hypothesis, and by the way, intelligent design as a scientific explanation is correct. As a theological explanation, it doesn't do the theological work that it needs to do. Okay? But you can learn an awful lot from it. Since the intelligent design hypothesis meets both the causal adequacy and causal existence criteria of a best explanation, and since no other competing explanation meets these conditions as well, or at all, it follows that the design hypothesis provides the best, most causally adequate explanation of the origin of the information necessary to produce the first life on Earth. And that is most certainly true. Yes. Oh, yeah, I did. Thank you. You know, this is a bunch of letters, so it's information, but it's also specified information. But we have to work at getting the specification. If you've been trying this out, which probably you have while I've been talking, you've either realised that this says, I saw a bum dance on a table, or I saw abundance on a table. Once we realise I saw abundance on a table makes better sense, again, we realise the pattern corresponds to something that makes sense in the world rather than a bum dancing on the table, you see? Complex specified information. We recognise it, we can work it out.